Okay, thank you. Okay, so what I'm going to explain, if you want, is some sort of a survey of conceptual ideas behind non-commutative geometry. And I mean, the story is more or less the following. If you want, I think it becomes more and more clear for people who are working in physics and in string theory in particular, that you know there is somehow geometrical framework which is needed, and I mean which of course has to go far beyond the usual Riemannian geometrical framework. Now it turns out that I mean such a framework has been developed and has been necessary also in mathematics, and I mean it has been developed through I mean perhaps the 20 last years. And I mean, sort of historically, if you want, it's I mean, it has been very familiar to operator algebraists for many years, long before the even the 80s, that somehow the theory of operator algebras is by itself a far-reaching generalization of both measure theory and topology. Now, what I'm going to begin by is, if you want, the place where really differential geometry began to enter in the scene. And this was at the beginning of the 80s, I mean, in fact, in 1980. And in order to do that, I will first concentrate on an example. And so if you want what, I mean, the basic idea is very simple. Basic idea is that algebraic geometry, for instance, uses a duality between a space, X, and on the one hand, and on the other hand, an algebra, if you want, which is the algebra of coordinates on the space. Which means, if you want, that there are two ways of thinking. There is one way which is geometrical, in which you can see pictures, and okay, imagine you have a proof because you have a picture. And another one which is algebraic, and in which you think by doing computations. Okay, and that's the algebraic side. And of course, there is this duality between the sort of picture side and the algebraic side. Okay, now, what has been sort of very clear from the discovery by Heisenberg of quantum mechanics is that, I mean, it would be foolish to stick to algebras of coordinates which are commutative. I mean, one has to go beyond that. Okay, now, as I said, operator algebras, of course, have developed, you know, through many people like von Neumann, Gelfand, and so on. And I mean, it has been clear that what people were doing there was non-commutative topology and so on and so forth. But somehow, it was a very hard subject, really very hard subject. You know, it's like if you are working with a rock, I mean, there is nothing. And it was missing computational tools. Now, these computational tools began to appear when examples came where it was obvious that the algebra was describing a space that was smooth and that was perfectly as acceptable as an ordinary manifold. And the first example of such a space I will describe, and the best way to access to it, so this space will be the non-commutative 2 torus, T2 theta. And I mean, it had appeared already from the work of Powers and Riffel, if you want, for computations of K-theory. But I mean, it really appeared as a smooth space in a contrarendu note, which I wrote in 1980, and in which, if you want, all the structure of the manifold and of the differential geometry of the manifold was displayed. And it turns out that this space appears as a special case of a completely general construction, completely general procedure. You see, when you look at the non-commutative world, you can think that you begin to understand this non-commutative world by taking the commutative one, and by sailing along the shore. By sailing along the shore, I mean perturbation theory, star products, okay? But this is really sailing along the shore, okay? Now, there are places which are much further, where the shore is no longer in sight, okay? And how to access to these places, you need a general principle. And the general construction is very simple. The general construction comes from the following idea, that, you see, you will describe spaces which are obtained by the operation of quotient. Now, most of the spaces we think about are obtained by the operation of quotient. Namely, we need to identify the points, and the points are classes, okay? Now, when you take this operation of quotient, you will find out that there are two ways of doing it with respect to this duality between a space and an algebra. You see, if we have a space X, which is defined as a quotient of some bigger space Y by some equivalence relation, then what we want to do is, for instance, to identify two points in Y, A and B. We want to declare that they are the same points. So the first simple way of doing it, algebraically, is to declare that you take only functions f which affect the same value at A and B. Okay? This is the first way. Now, if you do that, this first manner, it is fairly obvious that you will get a subalgebra of the algebra of functions that you had on Y. And it will inherit the commutativity of the algebra of functions on Y. Okay? So you wouldn't leave the commutative world if you would do that. But there is another way to do that. And this other way is sort, as we shall see, is much more, much smoother, if you want. It allows to deal with much more complicated situations. And instead of saying that, if you want, you take this cohomological condition that the function has the same value at A and B, which might be very strong, what you do is you allow the functions to take different values at A and B, okay? But you want the points A and B to be related to each other, to speak to each other. And to speak to each other means that, in fact, you allow off-diagonal matrix elements so that you will represent the value at A as FAA, the value at B as FBB, but you will allow for off-diagonal FAB and FBA matrix elements. Okay, and the multiplication is obvious. When you do that, you'll find that instead of having the constant functions here, namely the complex numbers, what you will get is 2x2 matrices. Now, the algebra of complex numbers and 2x2 matrices are almost the same for all purposes. They are called Morita equivalence. And this equivalence, for instance, tells you that the theory of the representations of these two algebras is the same. And when you look at the spectrum of this algebra, it's really a single point. So what you have done is to identify the two points in a way where instead of having this cohomological condition, f of a is equal to f of b, you will have plenty of functions, because at least you will have the old functions. They will sit diagonally in the new ones. Okay? Let me give you an immediate example in which these two ways differ drastically, and in which the second answer is very clear, very nice, will give you, in fact, the non-commutative tutors, whereas the first answer would give you nothing. It would just give you the complex numbers. Okay? So the situation is the following. Let us start with a quotient, which is hard to take. And this quotient is the following. We take a differential equation, the simplest possible. We just take dx equals theta dy, okay, in the two variables x and y. And we look at periodic conditions. So we are on two torus. Okay, I could draw this two torus equivalently like this. And we look at this equation. So, I mean, it has solutions which are leaves of a foliation, okay, and which I could picture here. Okay, as winding around in the torus. And what we are interested in is a space of leaves. Okay, so let me show you immediately that this space of leaves is described by a very simple and nice algebra. You see, so if I want to know what is a space of leaves, I know that every leaf will intersect this transversal. This transversal will look in this circle like this. So let me call it T. Okay, so it's... Now, every leaf will intersect the transversal. But, however, of course, if I start with a point in the transversal, there are many other points of the transversal which actually give me the same leaf. Okay? So, if I would take the first operation of quotient, I would only consider functions, infinity functions on the transversal, which are such that f of this point A is equal to f of this point B, f of A is equal to f of B. Now, of course, the relation between A and B is that B is equal to A plus theta, okay? And, I mean, it's a one-line proof that there are no such functions, because their Fourier transform would be, okay, has to be constant, obviously. I mean, has to be carried by zero. So you see that there are no such functions. So the first way is a bad way of doing it. What does the second way give us? Well, it's fairly obvious what it gives us. It gives us matrices, FAB, okay, FAB, where A belongs to the transversal T, B belongs to the transversal T, but A and B are on the same leaf. A and B on the same leaf. Okay? Now it is clear that if I give you A, there will be only countably many B's. So I will be able to multiply these matrices by the rule that FG at AC is equal to the sum, it will be a discrete sum, of FAB times GBC. All right? So all of that is pretty clear. Now what is this algebra? Well, it turns out that it is generated by two elements. The first one I will call U1. And U1 is just a diagonal matrix whose diagonal values is equal to, so U1AA, if you want, the diagonal value, is equal simply to the exponential of 2 pi IA. Okay? I mean, this is what remains of the functions which were diagonal before on the space. Okay? Now I have to make the identification between the points. And there is another matrix, U2. U2 is a matrix so that U2AB, so U2AA plus theta is equal to 1, and U2AB is equal to 0 otherwise. Is equal to 0 if B is different from A plus theta. Okay, so it achieves the identification. Okay, it's not hard to see that any of these matrices will now be a combination of the previous one. Okay, it will be in fact, so now we can already, even though we don't have the space, I can give you what is the algebra. So C infinity functions on T to theta, okay, they are just exactly Fourier series, sigma of A and M, U1 to the N, U2 to the M, okay, where the sequence A and M, I mean, it's a sequence where N and M are relative integers, okay, and where the sequence A is of rapid decay. So exactly the Fourier series for the ordinary functions on the ordinary two torus, except that there is a nuance, okay? So when you compute, when you add these things, you will add them component-wise, but when you make their product, you have to be a bit more careful. And of course, what happens is that these two matrices, U1 and U2, do not commute. That's exactly what was going on here. But they satisfy a very, very simple rule. And the rule is that, which is a two lines computation, is that U2, U1 is equal, in fact, to exponential of 2 pi I theta times U1, U2. Okay? All right, so now there is a dictionary which allows one to translate the classical geometrical notions, which are sort of visual, into algebraic notions. And the first line of this dictionary is what translates the notion of a vector bundle. So a vector bundle E over the space X, when you look at it from the algebraic point of view, you don't think of it, you know, as one fiber per point, but you think of it by the space of smooth sections of the vector bundle. Now, smooth sections of a vector bundle, of course, can be multiplied by functions, and so they form a module over functions. And this module has certain quality, which was found by Serre and Swan, and this quality is to be finite and projective. So this is no big deal. If you want, it's really like if you were dealing with linear algebra over a field, you would first deal with finite dimensional vector spaces. Finite means it is finitely generated, and projective essentially means it's like a vector space. So it happens, if you want, that not only free modules are interesting, there are modules which are complemented to a free module, and they are called finite and projective. So finite projective modules over the algebra A. Now, it turns out that in this geometrical example of foliations, which is general, I mean, there is nothing particular to the specific foliations that I have chosen, there is a completely general construction of finite projective modules, which is the following, which is that, you see, now I can choose another transversal to the foliation. And for instance, I can choose, instead of having chosen the transversal T, which was here, I could have chosen this other transversal, which I will call S. Okay? Now, if you permit me this sort of abuse of language, the matrices I was considering to start with where T cross T matrices. Okay? I mean, the entries in the matrix were elements of T. So I was dealing with T cross T matrices. But nobody prevents me from considering now S cross T matrices. Okay, and if I consider S cross T matrices, what will they be? They will be just a xi of, let us call this X and A, okay, where X belongs to S, A belongs to T, but X and A have to be on the same leaf. Okay? X and A on the same leaf. So they are rectangular matrices. They are no longer square matrices. And because they are rectangular matrices, I can certainly multiply them on the right by square matrices whose indices are in T. I will obtain in that way what is called the right module over the algebra. Okay? And it's a very nice fact, okay, which is the following, which is that whereas when you consider pairs of points A and B, which are on the same leaf, I mean, and which belong to T, the topology of that is just a union of circles. Okay, I mean, it is T cross Z. And this is what was giving us the generators. But now when you consider pairs of points which are in S cross T and which are equivalent, the very nice surprise is that what you find is a real line. See, this is a little bit surprising. I mean, so what you find is a real line. Okay? You find the infinite real line. So then what you find out is that these S cross T matrices, which apparently are labeled by two indices, in fact, they are just Schwarz functions on the real line. Okay? So in other words, S cross T matrices, if we call them epsilon, epsilon is in fact the Schwarz space of R. Okay, and this Schwarz space of R is now a right module over the infinity of T2 theta. Okay, I mean, it's again a two lines proof to prove that it is finite projective just from the geometry. And it's a right module over the infinity of T2 theta. And concretely, how is the right module structure defined? You see, I have to give you what is xi u1 of S and what is xi u2 of S. Okay? Where S is a variable in the real line. Now, xi u1 of S, without surprise, is just multiplication by exponential of 2 pi S multiplied by xi of S. So it's just a multiplication operator. And xi u2 of S is more interesting. It is just obtained by xi of S minus theta. All right? And one checks that the presentation of the algebra, which is given by the commutation rule, you know, that u2, u1 is equal to lambda, lambda is exponential of 2 pi I theta, multiplied by u1, u2, is preserved by this action. Okay? And it's a finite projective module over t2 theta. Okay, so now if you want, what happened was, okay, this is a very nice description of finite projective modules. And thanks to the theorem of Pimsner and Voiculescu on the computation of the K-theory, in fact, one can prove that it exhausts the K-theory. Namely, now if you start with arbitrary closed geodesics of the two torus, and you perform the same construction, then you exhaust all of K-theory. But now, however, you know, there is something much more interesting which appears, which is that now we can begin to do differential geometry. And we can begin to do differential geometry because not only because we started with a purely differential geometrical setup, okay, in which, as you can see, I mean, there is a lot going on up in the foliation, but we can now understand things directly at the level of the algebra, and we can almost forget about the foliation for a while. So you see, what happens is that, okay, let's be a little bit rough and forget that these u1 and u2 do not commute, okay? Now we would get ordinary functions on the ordinary torus. Now, torus is something very simple because it's a parallelizable manifold. So it has, in fact, two vector fields which commute and which span the tunnel space at every point. And when we write these vector fields algebraically, they are just derivations. What are these derivations? They are delta j, which is 2 pi I for normalization, multiplied by uj d by duj. So, for instance, delta 1 of u1 is equal to, well, let's compute something more. Interesting, let's compute, for instance, delta 1 of u1 square u2, okay? You see that what will happen is that you will have, u2 will not matter, and u1 will give you a factor of 4 pi I times the same term, u1 square u2,
Okay, so I hope you see how it works. So we have these two derivations. These two derivations commute delta 1, delta 2 is equal to delta 2, delta 1. And you see, I mean, here there is already a nuance with the commutative case, which is that, oh, you could tell me, but why didn't you take d by duj? Now, the point d by duj is not a derivation. And in a non-commutative case, you cannot multiply a derivation by an element of the algebra because you don't know where to put it. You don't know whether you have to put it on the left or on the right. There is this ordering problem, and it breaks the fact that it is a derivation. So you have to be very careful. Okay, so these are the two derivations. They commute. And once you have two derivations which commute, it is not very hard to guess what should be the notion of covariant derivative, of covariant derivative, covariant differential, if you want, and of curvature, okay, and we shall see much more, of course. Okay, so I mean, the covariant differentials, what they are, I mean, or connection, if you want, the gauge theory, what is it? So what you want, of course, is to have a non-trivial bundle. I mean, it could be trivial, for that matter, but so you want a bundle. And then you want, so this bundle has a space of sections. Finite projective modules are called epsilon. And the covariant differential in that case would just be given by two covariant differentiation operators, which goes from epsilon to epsilon, okay? And which have the properties that they satisfy the Leibniz rule, namely del j of xi times a is equal to del j of xi times a plus xi times delta j of a. Okay, so they do satisfy the Leibniz rule with respect to the derivations. Now, what was very striking from the start with this construction was that there were two obvious covariant differentials on the Schwarz space. You see, because what you want is that the first covariant derivative, del 1, should satisfy with respect to U1, the ordinary Leibniz rule. It's not hard to guess that you should take del 1 of xi is simply the derivative of xi prime. Okay? I mean, you will check a one-line thing that it works. And the second thing is that similarly for del 2, del 2 should satisfy with respect to translation the Leibniz rule. Now, it takes a little bit of thinking, but delta del 2 of xi of s, what you find out is that it is equal to 2 pi I s over theta times xi of s. Okay. All right. Okay, so now what really got things started back in 1980 is the following fact, following very, very specific fact. You see, when you have a vector bundle over a space X, you can compute its dimension, the dimension of the fiber, okay? And you can extend the definition of the dimension of the fiber to the non-commutative case. It's not a big deal. What you do is you take the minimal number of sections that you need to generate the bundle. Now, it can be that when you take the direct sum of the bundle n times, you need less than n times the number of sections you needed before. So you have to optimize that, okay? You have to take the limit for large n, divide by n, okay? Now, the amazing fact is that when you compute the dimension of this Schwarz space, what do you find? You see, when you compute the dimension of the Schwarz space S of R, okay? Well, you find an irrational number, you find theta, okay? The geometrical meaning of that is quite simple, is that what is this dimension? After all, as I said, we were dealing with not square matrices, but rectangular matrices, okay? Now, rectangular matrices, we have to know that they are like PQ matrices. Let us say that this is a 1 by 1 matrix, okay, normalizing by 1. Now, what is the 1? The 1 is a shadow, okay, of the transversal. So now what we have to do, we have to take on the leaf space, we have to take the size of the shadow of this other transversal, okay, according to the leaf space. But this shadow has exactly size theta, as you can see, okay? So in fact, these rectangular matrices were theta by 1 matrices. And of course, from that, you understand immediately that the dimension is theta, okay? Now, having a dimension theta might be a little bit bothering at first because you might say that you are completely in different waters from ordinary waters of differential geometry, okay? Now, the true place where things got really started is the following constellation. So the dimension of the bundle is theta, okay? But now we can compute the curvature. And the curvature for this connection happens to be a constant. What is it? It's k, which is del 1, del 2, minus del 2, del 1. OK, I spare you the 2 pi I factors. And what does it give us? You see, of course, del 1 is differentiation. Del 2 is multiplication by the variable. Curvature is a constant. And up to factors of 2 pi I, mean, you know, it's 2 pi I, but it's 2 pi I divided by theta. OK? Now, what does this mean? This means that if we take the integral curvature, namely, if we take the curvature, but we have to take the trace along the fibers, the trace along the fibers is a dimension. OK? And now theta drops out. OK? Now theta drops out. So theta drops out, and there is an integrality phenomenon which is appearing. Namely, the integral curvature is an integer. So I mean, this point really, so the integral curvature is an integer. Okay? So I mean, of course, when you see something like that, you find out that, there are several things that you have to understand. First of all, you have to understand the conceptual reason why it's an integer. OK, I mean, it's not enough. In fact, in the contrary note, what I did concrete computations also with the Riffle's power projections and so on to check it in a different way. But I mean, it's so now what you need to do, I mean, there are several things. You know, a very good example is always the best thing one can get to get started. I mean, you know, a general theory only takes its value from very concrete and explicit examples. Okay, so now what was needed was the conceptual explanation for this integrality. Okay, so it turns out that the conceptual explanation for this integrality is an index formula. I will come back to that later, so let me postpone it. But if you want, when you see this example, you sort of one is almost naturally led to, if you want, what are the correct formulation in the general case. Okay, namely, in the general case, what one will be starting with is simply non-commutative algebra. There will be no extra data. Okay, of course, foliations give thousands of examples. You know, it's a little bit of a pity that somehow, this is the only foliation you can draw. But, there are billions of foliations, and each foliation gives a corresponding algebra, and this algebra has many, many interesting properties. I mean, just to quote one, the Eurocycle foliation on the unit cosphere bundle of a Riemann surface, something extremely interesting, which has many, many interesting properties, which are much more subtle than this one. For instance, the algebra of the foliation does not contain any projection, even though the K-theory is very large. Okay? So, I mean, okay, so now what happens, though, is the following. What happens is that one can summarize what was going on in this curvature and connection computations and in the gauge theory and so on. One can understand it in a way which will make no use of commutativity. And what it will allow to do, if you want, is to understand in this in the general case, I mean, you know, in the general theory, what will be the replacement for the differential forms, I mean, for the Durham theory, and in fact, for the Chern-Weyl theory of characteristic classes. So this corresponding theory is called cyclic cohomology. So if you want, there is a perfect replacement in general for the Chern-Weyl theory, for Durham. Plus Chern-Weyl theory. And instead of describing this theory, because it would take me too long, what I will do instead, I will give you an exercise. And what I claim is that if you do the exercise without looking at the proof, you will understand the general theory. Okay? Now, K-theory, I don't have to describe K-theory. K-theory is described in equivalent ways, either by finite projective modules, okay, which you want to classify exactly as you would classify linear algebra, by their dimension. So, you know, you create the Grothendieck group, or you add them, and so on. But now, you see, you want to have invariance of K-theory. What you need is to be able to get invariance of K-theory. Okay? And, of course, the simplest invariant was the integral curvature. Now, there is another equivalent way to describe K-theory, which is sort of equivalent, but a little bit, perhaps a little bit more concrete, which is the following. You can describe, instead of talking about finite projective modules, you see, a finite projective module is something which, because it's projective, it will be complemented to a free module. So equivalently, you can write it from an idempotent E equals E square, and self-adjoint, if you are in the self-adjoint situation. And so E will belong to Q by Q matrices over the algebra A. Okay. Now, because we are working with non-commutative algebras, whether we start with A or Q by Q matrices over A doesn't make any difference. Okay. And really, to find invariance of K-theory, you can think that the projection E is in A. Okay. But now you need to construct invariance of K-theory. Now, here is the exercise which constructs invariance of K-theory. So the exercise is the following. I don't want to erase here. Okay, so the exercise is the following. You see, so let A be an algebra, not commutative. Let A be an algebra. Okay, and let tau be a trilinear form on A. Okay, so by a trilinear form on A, I mean, you know, that I know tau of A0, A1, A2, where these are elements of A, and this is a complex number. This is a complex number. Okay, let me assume two hypotheses on tau, such that, okay, and the first hypothesis will be that it is cyclic. So tau of A2, A0 is equal to tau of A0, A1, A2. It is invariant under cyclic permutations. Okay? And the second condition is the following. You see, if tau was a function of a single variable, I would simply write that it is a trace, namely that tau of AB is equal to tau of BA. But I wouldn't write it like this. I would write tau of A0, A1 minus tau of A1, A0 is equal to 0, if you permit me. Okay? Now, there is an obvious generalization of this with three entries, which is the following. It is tau of A0, A1, A2, A3 minus tau of A0, A1, A2, A3 plus tau of A0, A1, A2, A3. I messed up. Tau A0, A1, A2, A3. And finally, minus tau, and you, this is the important term, you put back A3 in front of the first term, A1, A2. So that should vanish. Okay? So make these two hypotheses. Then the claim is the following. Then the map, which to a projection E equals E squared, associates tau evaluated diagonally on E, is an invariant of K-theory. And if you want to have this in a concrete form, okay, so if you want to prove this in a concrete form, so because I want it as an exercise, so the exercise is to prove that if I move T continuously with a parameter, okay, so T now, E now depends on the time parameter E of T smoothly, okay, and satisfies E of T squared is equal to E of T, then the exercise is to prove that tau of E of T, E of T, E of T is constant. It doesn't change when you move the projection continuously. Okay? It's not affected by a continuous motion of the projection. That's the lemma. That's the lemma. And it is this rigidity that tells you that it's an invariant of K-theory. When you move along the projection, you see this value doesn't change. Okay? Okay, that's the exercise. Now, if you understand that, you are absolutely ready to understand what is cyclic cohomology. You see that in the formulas which I have written, there is a cohomological condition, which is this one, that can be written in the form B tau is equal to 0, okay, where B is the so-called Hochschild coboundary. Okay. Now, if you want to have a concrete example of the previous lemma, let me give you two examples. Example A, take a surface sigma, okay, and take, which is oriented. Take an oriented surface, sigma 2, okay? and take the algebra which is smooth functions on sigma 2. Okay? Now, what you can do is the following. You can consider the functional tau of f0, f1, f2, which is the integral on sigma of f0 df1 wedge df2. All right? This is well defined. And I mean, it is cyclic and it satisfies this condition. This is by the Leibniz rule of D. Now, the claim is that the invariant of K theory that you get, then tau paired with the projection E, is exactly the integral of the first chain class, C1, of the vector bundle on sigma. Okay? Okay, that's easy to see. Now, the second example is much less commutative. So, example B, go back to here, okay, and define the functional tau by tau of A0, A1, A2 is equal to the integral, by this I mean the Fourier mode at zero in the trigonometric expansion, integral of A0 times delta 1 of A1 times delta 2 of A2 minus delta 2 of A1 times delta 1 of A2. Okay? Now you can check that this functional satisfies the first two conditions. And so you get a K-theory invariant, which is exactly the one which is given by the integral curvature. And you see the reason for cyclicity is the following. I mean, let me use a physicist language and say that when you pass to matrices, you have to add Chan-Panton factors. Okay? Now, this means that, you see, even if your tau, your original tau, like here, was fully anti-symmetric, namely was anti-symmetric under all permutations, when you put the Chan-Panton factors, you tensor it by the trace of the product of these factors. But this is only cyclic. So the full anti-symmetry is lost. And the only anti-symmetry which remains is cyclic anti-symmetry. And this is the origin of the name, cyclic cohomology. Okay? So it turns out, if you want, that under the Hochschild coboundary, the complex of cyclic cochains, namely those which satisfy this first condition, with the signature of the permutation in arbitrary dimensions, it is stable. So it is a complex. And its cohomology is called cyclic cohomology. Now, so in the general theory, if you want, it's quite powerful. What you have is that the Durham and the Chernveil theory are replaced by cyclic cohomology, HCN of A. And it's a theory which has more subtleties than the ordinary case. For instance, what happens is that cyclic cohomology has a periodicity operator, S, which goes from HCN to HCN plus 2. Okay, and the correct theory which replaces the Durham theory is what is called periodic cyclic cohomology, PHC of A. And this has an even and an odd component, PHC even and PHC odd. Okay, and of course, it gives the Durham cohomology when you take A equals smooth functions on a manifold. That's very easy. So it gives the ordinary Durham cohomology. That's not a problem. But in general, it has more structure than the ordinary cohomology of manifolds because it is not graded, it is filtered. You see? It has a natural filtration instead of having a graduation. Now, this shows, in the case of the non-commutative torus, and it shows as follows. It shows in a very interesting way because if you want, it shows by a sort of even analog of the Jacobi theorem, of like for elliptic curves. So, and that's a remark, but I mean, just to show that the non-commutative theory is much more elaborate. So what happens is that in cyclic cohomology, okay, it turns out that there is an integral lattice, exactly as the lattice of K-theory in ordinary cohomology. Okay, so there is an integral lattice, as in ordinary cohomology. But as it turns out, if you want this integral lattice in cyclic cohomology, so in periodic cyclic cohomology, let us say even, for instance, and let us look at the case of the non-commutative torus. Okay, so what happens? I mean, I don't put C infinity of T, you know, I put just the non-commutative torus. So there is an integral lattice, but this integral lattice, if you want, I mean, this integral lattice fails to be compatible with the filtration of the cohomology. And the way by which it fails to be compatible with the filtration has the following properties, that what you can do exactly as in the Jacobi theorem. You can take the Jacobian, and the Jacobian would be the quotient, the even Jacobian would be the quotient of the periodic cyclic cohomology by the lattice. This would give you a torus. Okay? But now this torus, because of the filtration of the cohomology, has a foliation. And the amazing fact is that the algebra of this foliation is the algebra you started with. Okay? And moreover, that the K-theory classes are obtained by just, if I give me any K-theory class, I take the transversal given by this segment, and I get the correct K-theory class. Okay? So you see what happens. I mean, there are many subtleties which appear now, because non-commutative tori like T2 theta, they also have a moduli space. So if you want, there is a moduli space of this very simple thing. But exactly as for the ordinary moduli space, if you want, this moduli space has a simply connected one, I mean one which is a covering, and one downstairs. And the simply connected one is you take theta, but now the value of theta, not only modulo 1, will matter. How can this be? Because you know we were writing the condition as u2 u1 is equal to lambda u1 u2, where lambda was exponential of 2 pi I theta. So we don't see where theta enters except modulo 1. But we can see how it enters except modulo 1 by following how the K-theory gets modified when we move theta. Okay? Namely, we not only give the algebra, but we give an isomorphism of the K-theory with Z square. What happens is that there is a monodromy when you go along one loop. Okay, and this monodromy is given by a 2x2 matrix, which is the matrix 1, 1, 0, 1. Okay, and so you see that it does matter. And now there is this very beautiful notion of Morita equivalence, which was introduced by Mark Riffel. So there is Morita equivalence. And Morita equivalence now becomes pretty obvious from the geometrical picture, because if you want, all the transversals give you the same leaf space. Now it turns out that because they give you the same leaf space, the corresponding algebras are Morita equivalent. Okay? So I mean, it turns out, and this is very powerful, that the group of fractional linear transformation, PSL to Z, namely the group theta goes to A theta plus B over C theta plus D, acts on the moduli space of non-commutative tori, and it transforms the non-commutative torus into a Morita equivalent non-commutative torus. So you see that even in this simplest possible example, okay, there is lots of structure, there is lots of things going on, but I mean, there is a mistake not to be done, and that mistake is to think that non-commutative geometry is non-commutative torus. That's not at all the case, okay, that's not at all the case, and it's absolutely mandatory that, I mean, one understands that it's a general theory, okay. And now what I want to do, if you want, is to explain that not only you have the standard notions of soft differential geometry, namely, after all, I call this soft because we have an external vector bundle. We are not talking about Levi-Civita connections and about the internal geometry of the space, okay? We are talking about something external. But what now I want to explain is that besides these notions, there is a perfect notion, if you want, of the geometry itself. Okay, so how did this come about? And why is it related, like, you know, to string theory and so on? So let me try to explain that. So how did it come about? You see, what was hidden behind the scene in the integrality of the total curvature was the fact that it is an index of an elliptic operator. And now, if you want, so the question, the natural question that came was, what is a manifold? What is a manifold in non-commutative geometry? And what is a metric? By metric, I mean the analog of a Riemannian metric. these are obvious questions. You know, and we cannot fool around. I mean, we really have to understand these two questions. I mean, there is no way. Okay. Now, it turns out that even if you ask to mathematicians what is a manifold, there is an extremely subtle and beautiful answer. And it's not you take two pieces of paper and you glue them together. Okay, that's a recipe. That's a cooking recipe. Okay. There is a very beautiful answer, and this answer is like this. It goes like this. It's through the work of many mathematicians. I mean, you know, Spivak, Denis Sullivan in particular, and so on. So what is it? You see, you take a space X, and you ask, I mean, what are the properties of X which are invariantly defined and which characterize manifolds? Okay. Now, the first one that you can see, of course, I am thinking of X as a closed manifold oriented. Okay. First property is that it satisfies Poincaré duality. Namely, that you have, you know, you have this cup product map which goes from hj of x to hn minus j of x, and which is an isomorphism, okay, which is Poincaré duality. Okay, so, you know, it's a very natural question of asking, is it true that if I take a space and I put aside the problem of that it might not be simply connected, is it true that if I take a space and it satisfies Poincaré duality, is it something like a manifold? Okay. Now, what Spivak did was to show that if you take such a space, what you can do, you can embed X into Euclidean space, Rn, in such a way that it has a normal bundle, but it is not a linear bundle. It is, if you want, a bundle up to homeomorphisms. So, in other words, it has a normal bundle, and each normal is homeomorphic to a Euclidean space. Okay? Now, the issue is really whether you can straighten this and make it into a vector bundle. Because if it were a vector bundle, you could use transversality, the term transversality theorem, and then you would get a manifold. Okay? So the real issue is whether this normal bundle, new normal bundle, can be sort of, if you want, raised to the level of a linear bundle. Okay? Now, it turns out that this is not at all a simple question, that there is a fundamental obstruction to do that. So in general, it's not true. Not true at all. Okay? And that what you need in order to raise this normal bundle to the status of a linear bundle is something which is Poincaré duality in a finer theory, which is not ordinary homology. And this finer theory has its cohomology side, K theory. So if you want, it's K theory. Okay, at the cohomological level. And on the other side, it is called K-homology. Okay. Now, the theorem of, you know, Sullivan in particular in 1970 is that actually, under the suitable hypothesis of high enough dimension and so on, this condition is necessary and sufficient. And the Pontryagin classes of the manifold are, in fact, the Chern character of the K-homology fundamental class. And essentially, they can be given an arbitrary value. Okay? So this K-homology fundamental class and the fact that you have Poincaré duality in K-homology is exactly the right notion. Okay? Now, amazingly enough, what Atiya discovered, Atiya and Singer, you know, and so on, and what they discovered, is that there was an equally good description to the Serre-Swan description of K-theory. There was an equally good description of the dual side of K-homology. And by equally good, I mean that it is so good that it doesn't use the commutativity. Namely, that if you start with a space, in fact, you will have to transit through its algebra of functions, which happens to be commutative, but, you know, this commutativity does not enter in the definition. And the K-homology cycles were described by Atiya as being a representation of the algebra in a Hilbert space. Okay? So for complex K-homology, this Hilbert space will be Z2 graded when the dimension is even. When the dimension is even. Okay? But there will be an elliptic operator, what Atiya called an abstract elliptic operator, and he took it bounded. Took it bounded, okay? Now, my main observation was the following, that, in fact, if instead of taking the operator to be bounded, one takes the operator like a differential operator to be unbounded and takes the Dirac operator, then what happens is that not only you capture the fact that it's a manifold, namely that it has a K-homology fundamental task, namely the data of the operator up to homotopy, but you also capture the metric. And so I will write down a very, very simple formula which will show that not only you get the fact that it's a manifold, but you also get a metric. And what is the metric? Well, you see, the metric now, we are given this data, which is called a spectral triple. So it's an algebra, a Hilbert space, and a self-adjoint operator. Self-adjoint operator, which is not bounded. Now, it turns out that if you want the metric, it's simply given by the following formula, that the distance, which would be the geodesic distance in the ordinary Riemannian case, of two points A and B, so in general, they will be replaced by states on the algebra, is equal to simply the supremum. So instead of taking the infimum of our Clank's, you take the supremum of the phase shift f of A minus f of B over all elements of the algebra, which have bounded energy, if you want, so that their commutator with D is in operator norm less than 1. Okay, that means that the gradient of the function is less than 1 everywhere. And it's two lines exercise to prove that it gives you geodesic distance in the Riemannian case. But it's also obvious that now this notion of distance makes sense in general. Okay? So that's what you find. Now let me give you an intuitive and obvious perception of this new definition from the physicist standpoint. Okay, which I really love. Okay? Now, what is it? It's a formula. Okay? And this formula is the following. So what is the new ingredient? You see, after all, in Riemann's notion of geometry, the new ingredient was that he had the notion of what he said is that you cannot take a chair and move it along because it will deform. Okay? The only thing that you can do is take a little stick, which is your unit of length, and you will be able to measure this any other length with this little unit of length. And when you expand this little unit of length at a point x, it will be given by ds square equals mu nu dx mu dx nu. Okay? Now, the beauty of what happens here is that, in fact, what you get is the following equation. It's not an equation for ds square, which is always bothering because you have the square. You don't have d, okay? It's an equation for ds. And what is the equation for ds? It is ds equals this. Let me explain. Okay? Okay. So you see, the right-hand side, you can think of it as two points very nearby, very close by. Okay? But physicists have a much better way to think about it. I mean, this is a symbol which occurs everywhere in Feynman graphs. This is a matter propagator. Okay? And as such, as a matter propagator, what is it? It is the inverse of Dirac. It's 1 over D. It's 1 over D. So it is the inverse of my D here. In other words, in this triple which I have defined here, the D, the symbol D, which is here, has dimension inverse of a length, okay? And it is used to probe distances. You see, when you look at this formula which I have written here, it's really the inverse of D which enters. Because I condition the function F by the fact that its commutator with D has some condition. If I multiply D by 2, okay, I will rescale by 1/2. The condition. Okay? Now, there is much more going on, which is very nice, but it's just amusing. But you find out that, you know, this is a compact operator, it behaves like an infinitesimal, and so on and so forth. Okay? Now, what is really interesting is the fact that you can now write down, I want to finish there, essentially, you can now write down the axioms for what is a non-commutative manifold, and what you find is that you really have to go all the way to the Sullivan theorem, and the Sullivan theorem uses what is called KO homology. KO homology imposes that on the Hilbert space H, you have an additional structure which is given by an antilinear operator which is called the charge, which would be the charge conjugation operator for ordinary Dirac spinors. But in general, the beauty of this operator is that it also coincides with the Tomita operator in operator algebras. And that means in particular that it allows to go around the lack of commutativity of the algebra by the following equation, that the algebra is not commutative, but what happens is that still there is a lot of commutation going on because A will always commute with G, B, G inverse, where B is any element of A, and this is any element of A. And moreover, there is a further condition, which is saying that essentially this operator should be differential of order 1. And this condition is that if you take D commutator A and you permute it with GB, G inverse, this is zero. Okay, so now and then one writes down the axioms, and they are fairly simple. Essentially, they give you the Poincaré duality. I mean, the axioms are really the Poincaré duality. So what I want to say, I mean, you know, two things to end. I mean, one is that you recover exactly ordinary Riemannian manifolds under suitable commutativity hypothesis, okay? But the second is that now it works not only in a non-commutative case, like non-commutative tori and so on, it also works in infinite dimension. And I mean, at the beginning of the week, I was discussing with Ed in Caltech, and what happens is that really when you look at the algebra of open strings, and when you look at the supercharge operator, and when you look, you know, at the algebra of open strings where you look at cutting in the middle and so on, then it turns out that exactly the right these axioms are fulfilled. So, I mean, they seem really to capture the correct notion of manifold in a very wide context where you are not stuck by commutativity and you are no longer stuck either by finite dimensionality. You see, the dimension of the manifold would be seen by the decay of the eigenvalues of the operator D. But, of course, if you take the supercharge operator in conformal field theory, I mean, the growth of the spectrum would be exponential. You would be in infinite dimension. Okay? Now, the point is that there are many, many other sources of examples than string theory or conformal field theory. For instance, you can start with your algebra A to be the group ring of a discrete group. And the fact that the group would be of exponential growth is exactly the equivalent of saying that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian would grow exponentially fast. It's exactly the same thing. Okay, the word length metric corresponds exactly to the, you know, to the values of the eigenvalues of the Hamiltonian. So what I am saying is that if you want, it sort of seems to be a fairly natural framework, and in view of, you know, for instance, the role that now K theory is playing in the classification of deep brains, I mean, of, you know, boundary values and so on, it seems more and more that there should be a lot more in common to this non-commutative geometry, you know, in all its aspects. I mean, not only the soft aspect, but also the rigid aspects with metrics and so on. And what is going on, you know, sort of in the stringy geometry, I mean, in what one wants to get from stringy geometry and so on and so forth. Okay, so I hope I did convey the sort of feeling. Okay. Questions? Should ask questions, you know, otherwise I will feel that there was no interaction. Of course, I didn't have much time to, you know, give you like the latest things or something, but still. What I talked about was fairly.
How do you see the S cross T turning into a line?
Well, that's a simple computation. You see, I mean, you have to do it, you can do it very simply. It's not obvious because you would think that this is totally discontinuous or something. No, it's just a line, just a perfect line. Yes?
Actually, I had a question. Can you elaborate on how you think about DS as being the propagator?
Of course, yes. Let me explain that.
Points, we have a formula for the propagator.
Yes, you see, yeah, okay, I mean, you know, this is, okay, you see, I mean, what I met when I was elaborating the general framework, I met the following difficulty, that somehow when you work in ordinary differential geometry, you have X mu's, and so you can use the ordinary differential calculus, okay? But when you are in this thing, you don't have this,
no,
okay?
When we do have them, can you make contact?
No, of course, no, but what I want to say the following, you see. So what happened was the following, was that, as it turns out, I just want to say that to answer your question, but you see, as it turns out, I mean, infinitesimals that we try to comprehend in a very intuitive manner, and some people try to comprehend with non-standard analysis and so on, but it doesn't work, okay? What I am saying is that there is an incredibly simple answer to infinitesimals, which is given by quantum mechanics. And what is it? You see, you take quantum mechanics, okay? Now, it has a dictionary, and the dictionary is that a variable, what we call a variable, a variable, I don't mean a number, a variable, okay? It's an operator. Okay, and the real variable operator in Hilbert space, of course. A real variable, it's a self-adjoint operator. Okay? I mean, you understand that. Okay? The values of the variable is a spectrum of the operator. The multiplicity of a value is a spectral multiplicity. I mean, we understand that very well. But what I'm saying is that there is an obvious room for infinitesimals. So what is an infinitesimal? It is something which is smaller than epsilon for all epsilon without being zero. Okay? Okay? So it is an operator which is such that norm of t is smaller than epsilon for any epsilon positive. Okay, this, as I wrote it, would mean that t is zero. Okay? But there is a much more clever way of doing it, which is that for any epsilon positive, I put the for any epsilon positive before. Okay, and I say for any epsilon positive, I can condition my operator by finitely many linear conditions so that the norm drops down to epsilon. Okay, so the operator is smaller than epsilon except for finitely many vectors. That's what we call compact operators. Now, compact operators form an ideal, exactly as infinitesimal should do. Okay, they have an order. An infinitesimal of order 1 is an operator whose nth eigenvalue decays like 1 over n. Okay? And amazingly enough, they have an integral. And the integral is given by what? Okay, it's given by the logarithmic divergence. And the integral of t is given by the coefficient of log lambda when you cut off the eigenvalues up to lambda and you take the trace, in the trace. Now, amazingly, what you can go and develop the differential calculus and the integral calculus in this scheme. Okay? Now, the beauty of this equation is that this is an infinitesimal, because it's a compact operator. For a compact manifold, the inverse of Dirac is compact. Okay? And then you can compute. For instance, you can compute for an n-dimensional manifold, you can compute the integral of a function times ds to the n. Okay? And you will find up to a universal constant the integral on the manifold of the function with respect to the volume 4, square root of g dnx and so on. Okay, this is very simple, but it goes very far. It really goes very, very far. You see?
And then you can connect the metric to the previous.
Yeah, sure. And then you can do curvature computations, you see. I mean, for instance, let me give you a very simple formula, which is that the integral of f ds square for a four-dimensional manifold normally doesn't make sense. Here it makes sense. And what do you get? You get the integral up to a constant of f times the scalar curvature times square root of g d4x. That's what you get. Okay? And curvature appears. Curvature, the Lévis-Civita connection, all of that appears completely naturally from this standpoint. Okay? So what I am saying, you know, I am saying there is a spectral geometry where everything is taken from this standpoint. And the reason why, I am very confident about it is not only many, many finite dimensional examples. People get often confused because they think the whole theory is finite dimensional. By no means. The supercharge operator is a very, very good example of what the theory tells you in infinite dimension. And it tells you that the infinite metric is exactly given by this operator. And then you can begin to do measurements and so on. But it's hard to construct. I mean, you know, if you really want to construct the Hilbert space, supercharge operator, you won't get it for no price. I mean, you really have to fight and to get the construction right. Okay? So, I mean, that's really the story. That's really the story. Yes?
The analogy with the open string theory, what is the operator J?
Ah, the operator J is the operator which interchanges the two sides of the string. Okay? And it's Ed who found it. You know, I was giving my talk, I was giving the axioms, and he said, okay. And indeed, it is antilinear. It is an antilinear operator, and it satisfies the right conditions. And it also satisfies the condition which is here, you know. Of course, I mean, if you interchange the two sides of the string, if you were acting on the left side of the string, the other side will act on the right, so they will permute. And when you permute with a supercharge operator, it's sort of local on one side, so it will still permute with the right-hand side. But for me, it was extremely pleasant because now I begin to understand what you guys are doing with string theory. Namely, you are dealing with some manifolds of infinite dimension, okay, and which are specific, which have some specific properties and so on, and which certainly at low energies can be understood as ordinary manifolds and so on and so forth. But I mean, it should give, you know, a general framework in which one can really begin to think. And
Thank you again.